You may proceed.
Good morning. I'm Paul Balwad. I'm here for Mrs. Blackwell. There are two issues here. There are two fires involved, the 2009 fire and the 2012 fire. I'm going to start with the last one.
But let me let you know that that microphone is primarily for the purpose of recording and not amplification. You might want to speak up a little bit louder.
Very good. Is that better?
Pull it right on down to you. There you go.
How's that?
There you go.
Okay. I'll have to lean over a little bit to get to it, sorry. I'd like to reserve, first of all, if I could, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
The 2012 fire is an entirely circumstantial case. As such, it's subject to the holding in Bishop v. Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth has the burden of establishing what are termed the links in the chain of circumstantial evidence it must forge to sustain a conviction. Motive, means, time, place, conduct. Giving up motive to the extent that Mrs. Blackwell had motive because she has an insurance policy, and giving up conduct to the extent that conduct is always arguable, we're left with three links that were not forged in this chain. We have time, place, and means. None of those links were established. There was no evidence provided for any of those links. The time of the fire was never established. It was never proven. It was never suggested when the fire actually started. It was discovered after 9 a.m., facts established that Mrs. Blackwell was miles away at an appointment at 7:30 and was nowhere near the scene. The means of the fire was never established. The means of ignition of the fire was never proven. The place was never established, in that the point of ignition was never proven. The general area where the fire is thought to begin was around a dishwasher, but there was no means provided, there was no means proven by which anybody could possibly set a dishwasher on fire. There just was no evidence presented whatsoever.
But does the evidence need to be at that level of precision?
There has to be some evidence. I mean, how did the fire start needs to be proven. That's the Commonwealth's burden.
You can't have an arson case where the experts are unsure as to the exact moment and the exact method of ignition.
Well, we're dealing with the Cook case from 1983. And the Cook case, which is based on bad science and which really needs to be revisited, provides that if the Commonwealth can disprove every possible accidental cause of the fire, that given the presumption that all fires are accidental, that if the Commonwealth can do that with expert testimony, then you can sustain a conviction on that basis. Now, I submit to you that wasn't done here. The Commonwealth did not exclude all accidental causes of the fire.
But they did exclude the dishwasher theory of the fire.
To some extent they did. Their own evidence is in conflict. One of their experts, the insurance expert who took custody of the dishwasher, who is not licensed in Virginia, he said that he was able somehow to exclude an electrical cause inside the dishwasher. However, the trooper, the state police agent, who was also qualified as an expert, he testified that he did take it to the dishwasher, that in his investigation, he concluded the dishwasher caught on fire. So the Commonwealth can't get above its own evidence. And in this case, their own evidence was in conflict. But that being said, you know, you're going back to the Poulos case, where this court stated that in arson cases, that the evidence has to would unerringly point to the defendant as the culprit. She wasn't there. She wasn't present. There was no evidence that she was present when the fire started. She was no evidence that she was
the last person to leave the house, right?
I don't believe that was established. She wasn't there. The evidence wasn't there, and the fire was discovered by her son, who returned to the house from Charlottesville after 9 a.m. But I don't believe it was established by the Commonwealth that she was the last one. But she just wasn't there. And so before you can convict on arson, you need to be able to prove all those five things, and they weren't proved. Now, the Cook case is bad law. I had each and every expert who qualified testify that their investigations comport with what's called NFPA 921, National Fire Protection Association 921, which is an industry standard for arson investigations, which has been adopted nationwide, and it was adopted by all the investigators in this case, which is based on peer-reviewed science. The problem with the Cook case is, although Cook claimed to have based his holding on the science of the day, and may have, it wasn't science, it was pseudoscience. There had been, before Cook in 1983, very little peer-reviewed science in arson science. There had been very little peer-reviewed work done. That changed beginning in the 1990s with the NFPA 921 committee, which was formed to conduct peer-reviewed science. And it was actually formed by an expert who testified from his backlog, John Montini. He was one of the founding members of the NFPA 921 committee. But the best science today proves unequivocally that a conviction for arson cannot be sustained on what's called negative corpus, the absence of accidental causes.
I thought it was a little more nuanced than that based on some of the expert testimony.
Well,
that was a general rule, but, you know, there were some exceptions. Right. There was a little flexibility. They were revising that standard.
Right. There is justice. And to the extent that the whole thing is subject to wishy-washy language and it's a general standard to be applied unless other circumstances exist, none of which were proven in this case. So, as far as this case goes, there were no circumstances given to justify an exception to the general rule that negative corpus should not apply. Well, of course, negative corpus is exactly what Cook states. Cook states that if you can...
But to what extent, I mean, obviously we ought to, our jurisprudence ought to be informed by the latest and best scientific findings. But, for example, you look at McNaughton, that's been the test since forever, and I'm sure any number of psychologists would say it doesn't make any sense based on the state of the art. But to what extent, I mean, this is just a circumstantial case. That's just been the same rule for hundreds of years. To what extent are we tethered to this document prepared by this outside board that says this is how it's done?
Well, you're not tethered to any document. I'm trying to untether you at this point.
All right.
You're not tethered to it, but it just makes sense. It makes sense for the law to comport with the facts and science and reason, right? Instead of pseudoscience, you know. And I don't want to devote a whole lot of time to the Cook analysis because you don't need to get there for the granted assignments of error. Even under Cook, the Commonwealth's case doesn't rise to the level it needs to sustain the conviction in the 2012 fire. The refused assignments for the 2013 fire, I would submit, if Cook went, then the evidence would not rise to the level to sustain a conviction.
Can a fact finder looking at the 2013 fire, which I think with the evidence was stronger on, say, look, what is the probability that these, you know, this lady keeps having her homes burst into flames and homes don't spontaneously combust? She's guilty of the 2013, and we're kind of on the fence about the earlier fire, and it's just improbable that they would keep burning, then therefore, well, you know, she's guilty of the earlier fire.
Homes can spontaneously combust. Actually, spontaneous combustion is...
Three times?
That's very unlikely. However, in this case, there was evidence that the home was fed by defective electrical service. There's definitely electrical fires reported in the first home that burned. There had been an electrical fire that had occurred, which was unquestionably accidental, which was discovered by the fire department before the fire that destroyed the house occurred. We had an expert that came in, Bob Drain, testified that he discovered a problem with a grounding circuit, and he explained what that meant. But in the service that supplied power to the property, and the evidence also established that both of these homes were actually, in effect, trailers. They were modular homes. But they were hauled to the site and connected to the same defective service.
The evidence was that those homes have to have the same or better standards than your stick-built or whatever homes.
Yes, but the defect in the service actually was in a piece of grounding equipment that was located outside the home. it wasn't inside the constructed home in that case. So, but it is true. I mean, it is true. It's suspicious circumstances. And that's what you're alluding to, basically, Your Honor. And you have that. This case is ripe with suspicious circumstances. But that's not enough. It's never enough. The evidence has to unerringly point to Mrs. Blackwell as having been the person who set these fires. And they can't even say how this fire started. They can't even say when it started. They can't even specifically say where it started. All the experts were questioned about fuel loads. What fuel began the fire? They don't know. What source of ignition? They couldn't point to. Right? So the evidence is just insufficient to sustain the 2012 conviction, even under Cook, even under the confines of the Cook holding. The 2009 fire, the one that destroyed the first trailer on the property, the jury acquitted on the arson and murder charge related to that offense. They found her guilty of false pretenses related to the insurance claim. The problem there is that she didn't say anything false. I mean, nothing demonstrably false. Except for, I didn't burn my house down. Arguably. All of the statements alluded to in the Commonwealth's brief and in the that you'll find in the appendix are either factually true statements or statements of opinion. But the most important thing is the insurance company didn't rely on it. They didn't believe her. They specifically said they didn't believe her, and they brought in their own arson investigator who testified at this trial, who concluded that, and he testified that he could not exclude accidental causes of the fire. And it was on his report, not on Mrs. Blackwell's report, that Allstate paid the insurance claim. So for a false pretenses conviction, you have to have a lie made with fraudulent intent.
But how do we know the jury didn't just do a compromise verdict on that one particular episode?
Because
it happens not infrequently.
Because they couldn't. Because there wasn't enough evidence to sustain both convictions.
Well, I agree with the logic of that. If it were insufficient as a matter of law and they could not have gone that far, but isn't that the issue? Could they have gone that far?
No, Your Honor, they could not. There was no evidence to sustain either charge. They have to have evidence to sustain both to reach a compromise verdict. And it wasn't there. Honestly, as I replied in my reply brief, the judge really should have struck it. And if the judge had struck it, as my assignment of error says he should have, then the jury never would have got it. So they shouldn't have been in a position of having to decide the issue. But I think you have the reverse. I think you have a punitive verdict based on a lack of evidence. You don't have a compromise verdict when there was sufficient evidence to sustain both.
If that's their frame of mind, why not do the higher charge of the arson and convict her of that?
Because they weren't that punitive.
Ah, okay. Mean, but not super mean.
Right. Well, I'm not mean, but you know, there are suspicious circumstances, and I think the jury was swayed. And I'll be honest with you here, Mrs. Blackwell didn't help herself out. Mrs. Blackwell is autistic. And she's a combative and feisty witness, and she didn't present well to the jury, and I think that may have swayed their emotion. But the question here is not her personality. The question is there evidence? And there just isn't. There, before you can convict somebody of arson, you have to be able to say, how did this fire start? That's the number one question. You have to prove that it's incendiary. And there is nothing in 2,000 pages of that transcript to indicate how the 2012 fire started.
But the strength of incriminating evidence often depends on the weakness of exonerating evidence. What hypothesis of innocence exists here, that there were three purely accidental, purely unexplainable fires in a row in which she collects insurance?
Well, there were alternative explanations, and she didn't collect insurance on all the fires. Right? But she did
she
not
tried.
Collect insurance on the 2013 fire. But there were...
Did she apply for insurance on the 2013 fire?
She filed a claim.
Okay, that's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it was never paid. But again, you're returning to suspicious circumstances. It's not her job to exonerate herself.
No, I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying that it is true that the strength of the hypothesis of innocence plays into the strength of the incriminating assertion.
Well, yes, it may, and there were several hypotheses presented. There were, another person, notably her son. There were other people at the scene at several of these fires, accidental fires, electrical causes. with all those, there were plenty of those presented. But ultimately, it's not her job to prove her innocence. It's the Commonwealth's job to meet the burden of forging those five links, and three of those links are unmet. And for those reasons, I'd ask the court to reverse and dismiss the indictment.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Rosemary Boyle on behalf of the FLE, Commonwealth of Virginia. I think it's interesting that counsel commented on what makes sense, because in a very big way, what this case is about is what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And what makes sense in this case, and there weren't just three fires. Actually, the record demonstrates that there were five fires in this woman's house. She only applied for insurance for three. But five fires, and at least in four of them, she was the only one who was in the house, or the last one in the house, or present when the fire started. Now, these hypotheses of innocence that he's mentioned today, two of which, one was an electrical fire, I believe, and the other was that her son set it. Her son testified. He said he didn't set the fire. The jury was entitled to make a decision about whether they believed his testimony or her testimony, and they excluded him as being a criminal agent, having heard his testimony that he didn't do so. With regard to the accidental electrical fires, there was testimony by experts with regard to the 2012 fire that he took apart the dishwasher and could not find any, and actually opined that it was not an electrical fire starting in the dishwasher or, in fact, from any other appliance in the kitchen, although the fire started near the dishwasher or even perhaps in the dishwasher. But it was not an electrical fire, and she was the last person in the house.
In fact, the dishwasher wasn't running at all.
It was not on, and that was the testimony. So under Hudson, which is a more recent case from this court regarding circumstantial evidence, the court has made clear that just because evidence is circumstantial, it doesn't add to the burden placed on the Commonwealth in a criminal case. There's not an additional burden just because there's circumstantial evidence.
Should we or do we need to revisit Cook?
I don't think this business about, look, in Knight, a fairly recent arson case, there was, it was very similar to this case, actually, in that there was some argument that there were other causes than electrical cause, and those causes were excluded, and the court said in that case that when other causes are excluded, and when there is no evidence of accidental cause, which there was none here, then the court can infer, if you will, that there, in the absence of those other causes, that it was of incendiary origin. So I think the reason he's talking about Cook is because of this scientific information that he's trying to get in. Of course, that's not really in an assignment of error. The jury didn't have to accept that. That was qualified. So I think that arson shouldn't be special. Arson is just like any other
but there is, I mean,
matter.
There is a lot of research now indicating that the way things were formerly done was inadequate, and some folks who were convicted of arson being freed and that kind of thing. I'm just trying to figure out what we do with all of that.
Well, I mean, and this is what I think the court has also said, though, that arson often requires circumstantial evidence in order to prove. And this is, frankly, a case that I think illustrates that. This woman had five fires in her house. She was the only one present when they occurred. Frankly, the experts went through and talked very specifically about the only reasonable hypotheses of innocence that could have been put forward, which was an electrical fire, and excluded those. She should not get a windfall because she was able to burn the entire house down in 2009. I think what we're talking about is whether or not she can use that. I argued that there could have been a compromise verdict. And certainly the evidence, I would argue, was sufficient to convict her of arson in 2009.
It certainly was weaker than some of the other fires, it seemed to me, in terms of the expert conclusions.
Well, because the house was completely burned down. But well, there was testimony from the expert in that case that the only electrical fire that could have been started, and I think he was very honest, would have been in the basement. And then he meticulously went through the basement and excluded all of the electrical wires and said, no, it didn't start in the basement. So if you read that in testimony in its entirety, he did exclude that as a cause of that fire. And this is a woman who had a dream about the house burning down the night before, which she imparted to her daughter.
Counsel, rather than talking about generally what happened in these two or three, five fires, could you focus on the elements of the crime in 2009 and what circumstantial evidence supports that?
Yes, Your Honor. So in 2009, with regard to the larceny by false pretenses, the evidence, I would argue, even if not sufficient enough to show what the Court of Appeals relied on as the intent to defraud and the false statement. What she specifically said in that case when talking to the investigator, she gave a story about what had happened. She heard popping noises. She woke up her husband. She went downstairs. She didn't go in the other person's room because he was a private man. There was a lengthy story given which indicated that it was an accidental fire and that she did not start it or did not know how it was started. And she then gave inconsistent and other statements involving the circumstances than this. The circumstances that she told the investigator. And so, therefore, the jury could have concluded that those statements were false because she said she woke up her husband, yet she told her daughter at the hospital that very night she couldn't wake up her husband. She said to another person that he was outside when she left, but she told the investigator that she had woken him up. So there were a number of statements that were false, and the purpose of making those statements was in order to defraud the insurance company.
How was their reliance?
Because they paid the insurance claim.
Right, but they may have simply believed that, look, we looked into this and we just can't conclusively say it was arson, therefore under the policy we pay, as opposed to the reason we're paying is because we accept her version. I don't think they did.
Well, they certainly, I think, didn't have all the information when they paid the claim. And that came back later on because there was testimony from these other people about her trying to get money and so forth and so on. And they didn't. There was no evidence that they had that information when they paid the claim.
Well, they certainly wouldn't have paid the claim if she said, no, I did it.
Exactly. Having knowledge of it, or that somebody, her husband, set the fire. I mean, short of any other accidental mechanism, which I would argue was excluded by the evidence here.
So, is your case that she got some money from the fire and you think she started it?
Yes.
I mean, that's what you base your largely by false pretense on. It doesn't have anything to do with any other evidence. It's just that.
Well, there's a lot of evidence that supports that she started the fire. I mean, she said she had a dream the night before. She's making false statements about what happened at...
Right, but that all goes to her setting the fire. It doesn't go to her trying to defraud the insurance company in any other way, providing them with other information that defrauded them that they relied upon.
She's providing them information in order to get insurance money about the nature of how the fire started. I mean, that is essentially the basis of filing an insurance claim, that Your Honor. So,
okay, it's not about her, like, claiming things that really didn't burn in the fire and that type of thing. You're saying
that
she made a claim.
There was some evidence, there was some testimony about her going to the policy limits and that
they had some suspicions about whether or not she had really come up with these things. But I know, I agree that the evidence is short on that. So, but I certainly think you can have inconsistent verdicts. And I would argue that the evidence is, and we can't know what the jury was thinking here, other than if there is evidence sufficient to show that she committed larceny by false pretenses, then this court must affirm that conviction. With regard to the 2012, get back to specifics, Your Honor, about the 2012 fire and larceny by false pretenses. She told the investigator that she believed that the fire, and I'm talking about the insurance investigator here because there was some, I think, torment on brief about how some of these statements were actually made to the criminal investigator. But she told the insurance investigator that it was an electrical fire and that it started in the dishwasher. And that was a false statement. It was a false statement because she had told her daughter the night before, or maybe a week before, that...
Let me ask you this. Even if she made that false statement and the insurance company didn't rely upon it, what difference does it make?
Well, they did rely upon it. They paid the bill.
Just because they paid it doesn't mean they relied upon that statement. You can say all kinds of stuff. And it's like, you know what, I paid the bill because my investigator went there and he didn't find any problem. That's why I paid it. It wasn't because of this lady that I don't really understand what she's talking about, said what she said.
Well,
so how do you prove that reliance?
I think you prove that reliance because when you apply for insurance, they do not pay fraudulent claims.
Well,
they stated that.
Well, let me ask you this. Did anybody testify that they relied upon what she said in paying her the money?
They said that they do not pay fraudulent claims that they believe to be fraudulent.
Okay. But they didn't say why they believe that this was not fraudulent.
Well, I think the evidence, but the question is, does the jury believe that it's fraudulent? Does the jury believe that she made a statement that was false? And does the jury believe that they relied upon it? And so...
It doesn't matter whether they did or whether they didn't.
No, absolutely. I would argue they did rely upon it. They relied upon it because they paid it because of what she said, because of the claim she made.
Okay.
I mean, I would argue that you don't have to say the magic words in a case like this. I relied upon such and such
a
statement.
But it seems like to me all you think you need to prove is that they paid the money. Like, she lied and they paid some money. So, ergo,
I'm not at all saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying she made a false statement. And a false statement regarding the nature of the fire that she's applying for insurance for, about the cause of it, which when you have insurance, they won't pay if you set your fire to your house.
So it's a reasonable inference that if you pay the claim based upon false representation, you were obviously misled because you otherwise wouldn't pay the claim.
And if the jury can reach that reasonable inference, and it's their... it is their prerogative to do so, and unless that's plainly wrong, this court can't reverse. Unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
All right, thank you very much. You have a total of 8 seconds.
The inference flies away in the face of evidence. The evidence was the insurance investigators did not rely upon the statement. They specifically did not believe her. They paid on the basis of their own investigation.
All right. Thank you very much. The court will adjourn.
All right.